Good evening, it's Sunday, May 30th, 2021. Coming up, we're a little over a week into the ceasefire agreement between Israel and Palestine, and while the rockets have paused, the core problems have not. We'll hear from Palestinian-American professor and author Dr. Hatun Bazian.
This is the fourth direct massive military assault on Gaza by the Israeli military machine in one of the most densely populated areas in the world.
An Israeli-born East Bay resident, Nadav Zegouwe.
Gaza needs to be in its own autonomy, and Israel will still maintain its own country.
So two-state solution.
That's the only way, yeah. That's the only solution.
And scholar and Palestinian rights advocate Norman Finkelstein says that Human Rights Watch's report a threshold crossed Israeli authorities and crimes of apartheid and persecution is a game changer.
Human Rights Watch says Israel's committing crimes against humanity in the West Bank, in East Jerusalem, in Gaza. Human Rights Watch says the idea of a Jewish state in the context of Palestine is not legitimate.
I'm Sharon Sabota, and this is the KPFA Weekend Evening News. Today, ultra-nationalist leader of the Yamana Party, Naftali Bennett, announced his intentions to take the place of Israel's longest-serving Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. Bennett would do so in partnership with centrist party leader Yair Lapid. Israeli media reported that under the proposed terms of the deal, Bennett would replace Netanyahu as Prime Minister and would later be succeeded by Lapid. The two would then hold a rotation agreement for the prime minister post. The proposed coalition government would reportedly be comprised of leaders from the left, right, and center of Israeli politics with little in common beyond their desire to see Netanyahu out of office. Bennett reportedly governs from the far right and is not in support of a sovereign Palestinian state, and Yair Lapid is a former television personality who is known as a voice of secular centrists. In a statement today, Bennett assured Israelis that Israel, under his leadership, would be oriented in far-right politics. He said he'd do everything he could to form a national unity government with his friend Yair Lapid. Netanyahu responded by calling Bennett the fraud of the century and by asserting that Bennett's approach would be a danger for the security of Israel. It's been a little over a week since a ceasefire agreement was reached between Israel and Hamas, bringing an end to the latest military conflict between Israelis and Palestinians in the region. But the agreement stopped short of addressing the root of the problem. To get a better understanding of the long history of conflict between Palestine and Israel, I spoke with an Israeli and a Palestinian in hopes of gaining a perspective about the root cause of the problem and what a solution might look like.
Gaza needs to be in its own autonomy.
That's Nadav Zegouwe. He moved to the Bay Area from Israel a little over a decade ago.
And Israel will still maintain its own country.
So two-state solution.
That's the only way, yeah. That's the only solution.
Gaza is the largest open-air prison with close to 2.5 million people.
That's Palestinian-American Dr. Hatun Bazian, a faculty member at UC Berkeley and the chairman of American Muslims for Palestine.
This is the fourth direct massive military assault on Gaza by the Israeli military machine in one of the most densely populated areas in the world. So until we begin to take Israel to task on its violation of human rights, if we continue pushing the Palestinians out, taking their lands, confiscating property, we're still going to experience and witness on our TV screen the complete violation of every standards that is known to the world community.
The latest crisis started on May 6th, when Palestinians reportedly protested in East Jerusalem over an anticipated decision of the Supreme Court of Israel on the eviction of six Palestinian families in Sheikh Jarrah. On May 10th, Hamas reportedly gave Israel an ultimatum to remove all security forces from the Temple Mount complex in the region by 6 p.m. Then, at 6 p.m., when no action had been taken, the group launched rockets. In response, Israel launched a campaign of airstrikes. By May 17th, the United Nations estimated that Israel had demolished more than 90 buildings in Gaza, including more than 460 housing and commercial units. And by the time the ceasefire agreement was reached on May 21st, with the help of Egypt, some 254 Palestinians, including 66 children, were killed, and another 1,900 were injured. That's according to the Gaza Ministry of Health. Israel reported 13 Israeli deaths, including one child, and another 200 that were injured. Bazian says in order to understand what is happening now, it's important to look at history.
Palestinians have been subject to this on and off violence and attacks since the British set foot in Palestine in 1917 and then transferred into a Zionist state in 1948. And we continue to face the attempted erasure.
Bazian says what is happening to Palestinians in the region boils down to settler colonialism, which he says we're all well acquainted with in the United States.
Settler colonialism engages in genocide and transfer. You don't need to go to come to Palestine to understand it. Just go down to the next reservation here in the United States and talk with them about, one, is their experience with genocide as the genocide unfolded, and the remaining populations were transferred to reservations. So those are the key pillars of settler colonialism. Palestinians have experienced genocide beginning from 1948 and a transfer. So transfer ethnic cleansing in 1948, about 750,000 plus, 531 villages completely wiped out, 8 urban centers. And now we're experiencing the transfer, the slow transfer program pushing Palestinians. 65% of the Gaza population are refugees from 1948. There's nothing complex about settler colonialism. There's nothing complex about stealing people's land. There's nothing complex of dropping bombs on the heads of children and then claiming that you're actually doing it in self-defense. You know, flying from 20,000 feet high with an F-16 and firing a missile, and you think that you are actually strong. That's just like, for me, is that it's a cowardly act that is being done on the Palestinians. And to see that politicians, whether Biden and some of those in the Republican and the Democratic Party, actually coming with a straight face, not on Comedy Central, to say that Israel have the right to defend itself against children.
And at the same time, as you said, this should be simple. But I think it's not simple for the simple reason that those who have power don't want to.
Well, that's a different issue. Power, okay, determines the outcome. That's, again, we have in Oakland every other day, 2 black men are shot by the police. We're in Berkeley. We have surveillance structures that are there surveilling people. We all watched 8 minutes and 46 seconds of George Floyd dying in front of our eyes. And still people stood up and say, well, maybe he was resisting arrest. What's often the case is that we don't talk about power. We begin to use what I can consider a dumbing down type of arguments. It is the Hamas. It is the Arabs are not sophisticated enough to know how to have democracy. So we need to beat them up. We need to liberate their women, because all these are what I consider dumbing down arguments that reflects of the racist attitude rather than anything else.
Zegue says, if not provoked, Israel would have taken no action.
So first of all, Israel did not initiate literally anything. Israel always like is a response. Israel, look at it like this, just as simple as it can be. Israel's the big brother, Palestine's the small brother. Small brother, big brother considerably is responsible, doesn't do anything to the small one. But the small one tease, you know, play with, and the big brother gets to the point like, all right, that's enough, and then we gotta do something about it.
Bazian responded,
I don't think it's very difficult to understand the narrative. Just compare it here to the United States. The settlers who massacred and committed genocide to the native population, every time that the native population put out some type of resistance, the native population was blamed for resisting. They should just lay it over and be walked upon. So this person who was complaining of saying the Palestinians need to stay in their place, let me ask the question, where is their place? Since you say that you have the right to still bomb them in Gaza, you're trying to evict them from their houses in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in Jerusalem, in Silwan, in Wadi al-Jouz, in al-Bustan.
Zigaway's response. What do you say to Palestinians who feel like they're being removed from their own home, like they don't have a place anymore?
That it's Israel's not their place, first of all. Gaza is, the West Bank as well, Ramallah area, and the Eastern Jerusalem anyways has like a Muslim quarter there. So that's already theirs, pretty much. They can't take Tel Aviv and, you know, the common area.
For Bazian, whose father is from the city of Nablus, and whose mother is from Jerusalem, those words are hard to hear. What possibility do you see for there to be a level of harmony between the Jewish population and Muslim population in the area?
They need to be independent. They need to know that they cannot throw anything. They cannot threaten Israel. They cannot interfere with Israel's day-to-day life. The fact that we hear it in the news is because like big cities like Tel Aviv and surrounding areas get bombs. Unfortunately, the areas around Gaza get bombs every day. Every day.
Just on a human experience level, some Palestinians talk about living in fear, not knowing when they'll be bombed. What were your fears growing up in this region?
Live in fear? I mean, it's that they're entitled to their own opinion.
For you? Did you have any fears as you grew up in the region?
It's not necessarily a fear, but you know it's always been going on. Sometimes it's like it's a really intense year, sometimes it's not, sometimes it can be quiet, but it's always going on. It's like it's like a boiling volcano.
Well, many around the world have called Israel's response unproportional. Zagouwe says he has a different perspective.
It's just like a basketball game. When you look at the result, yeah, you see who won. You see who has more loss, more points. In this case, when you compare 300 to 15, you can't exactly prorate them together, like to see, that they got more, so they're suffering more. But it's not the case. It's because, first of all, they initiate that. We're not going against civilians. We're going against strategic areas that has the IDF interest on taking down, so this foundation won't exist anymore. And on the other hand, let's say I'm a high-ranking officer in the Hamas organization. They know that Israel is a very humanitarian group, and what they're doing is like they're hiding behind them. If there's a kid right here, I'll be right behind it. There are tunnels underneath schools, underneath hospitals.
Bazian says that is merely a convenient argument used to justify the actions of the Israeli military.
The Israeli military and their spokespeople have been using this term of that Palestinians, they're using human shields, so we have nothing to do with the fact that large number of civilians die. Actually, the international law, the 4th Geneva Convention and rules of engagement are very clear that if you have a civilian, and even if you suspect that there are militants or military in close proximity, you actually have to withhold the attack on the civilians because you actually might impact and hit civilians. So Israel uses this term that since the whole Gaza Strip is governed by Hamas, and Hamas is a designated terrorist organization by the United States. So therefore, every part of Gaza is a legitimate military target because the health ministry is run by Hamas, and therefore anyone is close to the health ministry is a legitimate target. Transportation, food supplies, everything is within this. And we only have to take the Israel statement on it that there is Hamas close by. Israel is, in essence, is in the business of trying to eliminate the desire of resistance on the Palestinians, and in essence, to try to remove them from the face of its consciousness. Israel is using bullying and taunting as a military strategy. Really, the question, do we mourn Palestinian lives? Do they count? And what the Israelis, and I would say a political elite in this country, Democrats and Republicans, with exceptions in terms of the Democrats, the Squad, and a few of the progressives, that Palestinians' lives don't count.
You're listening to the Weekend Evening News on KPFA 94.1 FM, KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno, K248BR 97.5 FM in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. I'm Sharon Sabota. Today, I'm in conversation with Nadav Zagouwe and Dr. Hatem Bazian about the ongoing conflict between Israel and Palestine. I asked Bazian about his perspective about Hamas being labeled a terrorist organization.
The Palestinian had election in 2006 in Gaza and the West Bank, and they elected Hamas as their representative. We are punishing them for their democratic election. But more importantly, Israel always tried to find somebody to hang their settler colonial coat on. Before Hamas, there was the PLO. Before the PLO, there were a bunch of Palestinians. Before the bunch of Palestinians, there were these Bedouins or these Arabs that challenged Israel. Regardless of what political leadership they have in there, Palestinians see Zionism supported by European colonialism and interests as the primary agents of terrorizing their community and have completely engaged in the dispossessions of the Palestinians. From 1917, when the British colonized Palestine and began to have the Balfour Declaration, until Netanyahu, who tries to clean his corruption case by bombing the Palestinians in Gaza. So I would say that Hamas, or using Hamas as a red herring in such a way to use it as the rationalization for terrorizing the Palestinians. If you think Hamas is your problem, okay, so let's go to Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in the West Bank. Who are the people that you're about to throw about 100 families out of their houses? How about the constant attack on Al-Aqsa Mosque, the sacred site of the Palestinians in Jerusalem? It's most every week you're assaulting people, including the whole month of Ramadan. So again, this red herring is used to excuse and signal to the Americans and to the Western audience that we are slaughtering people that should be slaughtered.
In terms of solutions, each has his own idea. Tsegue sees it as simple and straightforward.
I think that United States or any other United Nations as well, should just make it very simple that it should be ceasefire, but in internal ceasefire. Like, if they start with anything, again, can be the smallest place, the smallest rocket or the smallest town, it doesn't matter. Everything counts. I'm 35, but hopefully one day that thing will be resolved.
Bazian says that while understanding the dynamics of power seems simple, dismantling them is what really needs to be done, and that's a little bit more complicated.
Just think about it. In Berkeley, we can barely take care of the homeless down in the streets. This is a country that says that they're the superpower. Superpower, if you can't take care of your own population, you're rejecting the humanity of people, and you're actually putting them out and think of them as a problem. There's a dynamic that even Martin Luther King, when he was speaking about the external colonial and the internal colonial, when he said that the bombs that we throw in Vietnam blow up in our inner city. So the bombs that we threw in Iraq blow up in our inner city. The interventions that we had in Afghanistan and different places are actually having the manifestation in our own society. And I would say that the United States is no longer capable of even tying its own shoes domestically, let alone being able to tell the Palestinians or anyone else in the world what type of shoes they should buy. So I'm a person that say what we need is a different politics here domestically that might be able to reshape the U.S. engagement across the world, especially as the war on terrorism has unleashed massive U.S. power. Palestinians going to gain their freedom because they will be asserting their right to gain their freedom, despite the persistence, despite the blocks, despite the lack of attention, despite the support to the Israelis, Palestinians will be free because that is who they are and that's what they set themselves up. The fact that we're facing Israel, the United States, before that Great Britain, and some of the Arab governments should not give us the sense that we are not on our trajectory to gain our freedom.
In the meantime, what words of hope or advice, if there was somebody in the thick of this in Palestine, struggling to keep their family alive, struggling to keep the home that they live in, what would you say to them right now?
I would say that keep your head up, continue to work, and you could see that the people in Gaza, they are not giving up. If there's a group that should be saying, that's it, we give up, it would be people in Gaza, but they're not. They're not giving up. Palestinians in the West Bank, I'm in contact with people in Sheikh Jarrah, contact people in Jerusalem, in Nablus, in Ramallah. They're saying, we're here. We're not going anywhere. And we're going to still continue to resist. Also, Palestinians are also looking in terms of their alliances and their solidarities with the Jewish community in here in the U.S., especially the young Jewish community that is no longer thinking of settler colonialism as Zionism as a way to articulate their identity. And that also is a sign of hope that decolonization is underway.
That's Dr. Hatin Bazian and Nadav Tsegue speaking about the conflict between Israel and Palestine. You're listening to the Weekend Evening News on KPFA 94.1 FM, KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno, K248BR 97.5 FM in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. I'm Sharon Sabota. Today I'm in conversation with Nadav Tsegue and Dr. Hatin Bazian about the ongoing conflict between Israel and Palestine. Scholar Norman Finkelstein, author of The Holocaust Industrial Complex, Gaza, An Inquest into the Martyrdom, and many other books, recently said that he has been interviewed so many times since Israel began its latest attacks on Palestinians that he fears repeating himself. So he held a Zoom press conference on Friday just to answer questions. KPFA's Ann Garrison was there to ask about international law and international human rights NGOs.
I had wanted to ask Norman about his seeming commitment to international law. I know, Norman, that you understand the International Caucasian Court very well and understand why a number of African members have withdrawn. Do you still put faith in this institution or in the idea of international criminal tribunals?
Well, let's start from the beginning. I don't put faith in any institutions, even institutions which I'm a member of. I'm old enough to recognize the fact that human beings are capable of many wonderful things. As Shakespeare said, what a piece of work is man. We're capable of quite wonderful things. We're also very capable of corruption, capable of being bought off, capable of being seduced by power, seduced by fame, seduced by wealth. Human beings have their good side and their bad side. And since institutions ultimately are led by human beings, I think a healthy dose of skepticism is always in order with all institutions, because people are, I won't say in all cases, easily bought off, but in all cases, 99 out of 100 can be bought off. So I don't put faith in institutions. On the other hand, I do believe that these institutions, if you can exert sufficient pressure on them, they can yield decisions which will be beneficial to the cause, because these institutions carry a lot of moral authority, for better or for worse. So in 2004, the International Court of Justice yielded a decision on the wall that Israel has been building in the West Bank, which was very favorable to the Palestinians. I thought that was an important victory. In the same way, I don't put faith in Human Rights Watch, but it must be said that's a very powerful institution. It carries a lot of moral authority, and its last report, entitled A Threshold Cross, was a very valuable weapon in delegitimizing aspects of Israeli policy. And it's now being very widely quoted by supporters of the Palestinians. Human Rights Watch says Israel is a state based on Jewish domination. Human Rights Watch says Israel is committing crimes against humanity in the West Bank, in East Jerusalem, in Gaza. Human Rights Watch says the idea of a Jewish state in the context of Palestine is not legitimate. That's a very powerful weapon. If you are involved in the struggle of trying to persuade public opinion, these are very powerful weapons. And Israel is currently in a panic mode. For those of you who know the United States scene, for the past 2 or 3 years, Israel's supporters have been targeting on college campuses what's called Israel Apartheid Week, IAW, Israel Apartheid Week. And Israel supporters are trying to say that's anti-Semitic, to call Israel an apartheid state, that the university officials should not allow an Israel Apartheid Week. Well, guess what happened? B'Tselem, Israel's leading human rights organization, said Israel practices apartheid. Human Rights Watch, the main human rights organization in the world, guess what it said? Israel's practicing apartheid in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and Gaza. Well, guess what that means? That means all of Israel's supporters' efforts to try to stop Israel Apartheid Week, they have no answer when Human Rights Watch and Israel's leading human rights organization say it's apartheid. That's a huge victory. They have been silenced. They have been stopped. They have been defeated because of those developments. Recognizing a victory for what it is and exploiting and capitalizing on that victory, I think that's what politics is all about. You win the battle for public opinion when you can get organizations and individuals commanding moral authority or political authority supporting your cause. And we shouldn't be purists about it and say, well, these are all Western colonialist, Zionist, imperialist organizations, and therefore we shouldn't bother with them. No, they're more than that. They command authority, they are susceptible to popular pressure, and there are victories that have been won.
Okay, thank you first for talking about Human Rights Watch. As soon as you started talking about the possibility of achieving victories in the ICC, I was reminded of what you said about Human Rights Watch and Bethlehem in your interview with Katie Halper. It addresses a problem I'm always encountering whenever I'm inclined to cite Human Rights Watch or Amnesty International because they got something right. I feel obliged to say how badly corrupted these institutions have been and this and this and that. And I worry that by citing them, I'm putting any credence I may have myself behind them.
You're totally right. You end up legitimizing organizations, which then make statements which are absolutely appalling. And then people come back at you and say, well, you said they're honorable. You said they're accurate. You said that they're just. And now they say X, Y, and Z, and you don't like what they say, and now you're condemning them. I think that's a problem. And the way I get around that problem, because I've faced that problem the whole of my adult life, is when they do backtrack, when they do act in a duplicitous way, I sit down and I try to demonstrate that what they're saying in this instance is factually untrue, and therefore I'm not obliged to support it. So in a book I wrote on, well, actually I wrote two books, one on Gaza and the International Criminal Court, and before that, one on Gaza and the human rights organizations. And I went through all the human rights organizations, Human Rights Watch, the UN Human Rights Council, and I showed that what they said about the 2014 Israeli assault on Gaza, Operation Protective Edge, I said it was all lies. But I didn't just say it. I documented it in about 350 pages, a very dense text. So I think you can do two things. You can cite Human Rights Watch when it says something which you can demonstrate is true, and you can also at the same time criticize or even attack those organizations when they're carrying on in a hypocritical or duplicitous way. I can attack Ken Roth, the head of Human Rights Watch, for how he carried on during Operation Protective Edge, but I can also praise him for the report that was just issued.
That was Dr. Norman Finkelstein answering questions from KPFA's Anne Garrison at a Zoom press conference on Friday. And the weather. In the Fresno and central San Joaquin Valley, we can expect excessive heat tomorrow with lots of sun and highs of around 105. In San Francisco, mostly sunny tomorrow with highs in the 70s. And in the East Bay, expect sun and highs in the 90s. That's it for this evening's news. Thanks to Anne Garrison for helping to prepare tonight's newscast and to EA, who's at the controls. I'm Sharon Sabota. Good evening.